When you started writing Sudden Death, did you ever have a voice in your head saying, don't do it, don't write something that reflects part of your own life and might have some autobiography in it?
No, I wouldn't have chosen the material. So in that sense, I was alienated from it. I didn't feel that it particularly was my life. I wrote it for a woman who, in fact, was born and raised here called Judy Lacey, who went on to become a reporter for the Boston Herald, and she traveled on the tennis tour. We became good friends. And like most journalists, she wanted to write a novel. And 3 days before she died, she said, will you do that book? Now, inevitably in the writing, it became the only book I could write. It'll never be Judy's book, but I did the best I could.
I should ask you how autobiographical the book is.
Not very, although people think everything that a fiction writer does is autobiographical. I obviously observed that world at close hand. But before I got to women's pro tennis, I'd been a tennis player myself in high school and college and was on my college team, and I was very well grounded in the sport as well as its history. So that finally getting on the women's pro tour was the end of an epic in my life, a sports epic, which oddly enough I never did think would become a book. But once it did, I was okay with it. But sure, everyone thinks that I'm in that book.
A lot of time is spent amongst the main characters in the book trying to hide the fact they're gay, or at least not make a point of allowing anybody to notice it. Do you think that that's necessary to do? Is tennis at the point now where you're kind of out if you're found out?
Nobody can prevent you from going onto the court and earning your keep, but you will certainly lose endorsements, and the big money is off the court, not on the court. You can make millions of dollars endorsing tennis rackets and shoes and sport brassieres, God knows what else, though. And, I mean, someday they'll have a tennis Tampax. I'm convinced of it. So that's where you'll lose the bucks, and the terror is high, and the price is high. So you're told, whether directly or subtly, you're told to lie, and you do. Most of them do. In fact, all of them do.
All of them do what?
They lie about whether they're gay or whether they're straight. But they also lie on television, and they lie in hospitals, and they lie in insurance companies. Homosexuals are the one oppressed group who are not visually discernible, and they get away with it.
One of the differences between tennis players and people who, say, work insurance companies is that they're watched and written about all the time. They're stars, and there's people who are paid to find out about their personal lives. Can I ask, when you were with Martina Navratilova, what you did to prevent people from knowing, if that was an important issue?
Nothing, because the libel laws in America are really quite clear. As long as Martina didn't say she was gay, nobody could say that she was, because you can then sue them for libel. They could say anything they wanted to about me, and they didn't. They just chose to ignore it. But when Martina and Nancy gave a press conference in August of 1981 to say that Nancy was curing Martina of lesbianism, what they were therefore saying was formerly she had been a lesbian. Well, that blew the lid off of it. Then the press could go after the story, which of course they did.
Why did she say that?
I have no idea. And if I did, I wouldn't tell anyway.
Right. One of the things that happens in the book, one of the ways of covering it up is being married so that you can have proof at your side of heterosexuality, and to keep, you know, a lesbian lover hidden someplace else out of sight. And I think for a lot of people that might have brought to mind Billie Jean King and wondered if there's some of her in that character or those characters in the book.
Well, Billie Jean's case was so completely different that I couldn't nor would I have put it into Sudden Death. But what I found remarkable about that whole experience, namely what she went through, was I think I have a very different viewpoint than the average person. Most people were quite sympathetic when that whole mess happened and said, well, poor Billie Jean, who cares if she's straight or gay? Well, that seems to me to be quite an enlightened viewpoint. But the more I thought about it, the more I got very nervous. What was happening was the woman who performed the man's job and got big money for it was the important person. The woman who did women's work was a wife, was characterized in the press as a sleaze, a gold digger, a blackmailer. And the message I began to get is, hey, when women act like men, they're important, but when women do traditional women's work, they're worthless. So I began to come out of that whole scene with very uncomfortable feelings about what this society is telling us women can do. I don't want to act like a man, particularly. And I don't think housewives are any less than people who run corporations. I guess I'm different than the rest of the country, but the message I'm getting is, hey, girl, act like a guy, and you're important. Make a lot of money, you're important. Stay home, take care of your husband or your lover, your children, and you're worthless. I think that's a devastating message to give to women.
Well, again, getting back to your book, there's the college professor who's lovers with the tennis star. Decides to give up teaching for a while so that she could travel on the tour and be with her lover, who likes to have her in the stands when she's playing. And someone mentions that, well, gee, isn't that being like the silent wife, except that you can't even get credit for being the person behind the star because you're not out. I guess that kind of thing happens where, you know, even in same-sex situations, someone is kind of taking the secondary role.
Except, you know, I don't think it is a secondary role, and that's where we're running into problems. We're not evaluating emotional labor commensurate with material labor. In other words, in any two people, I don't care what the combination is, the person who's the main source of emotional support, as far as I'm concerned, is as important as the individual who's out making all the money. You can see it in political groups. Let's remove it from sex for a minute. In order for any political group to function, there's somebody that becomes the task leader. That's the individual that says, we're going to reach this goal. And they subordinate everything, including their own emotional life, to reaching that goal. There's somebody else that comes forward, if the group is successful, who's called the maintenance leader. And the maintenance leader has to repair all the emotional damage that the task leader has done to everyone in the group, as well as try to emotionally maintain the task leader. So you would say that, in a sense, a maintenance leader is a wife. And that labor is critical. Why are we always devaluing emotional work? I mean, it's and sudden death. That wasn't the central issue in sudden death. The central issue is, what price is your integrity? Are you going to stand up and fight for yourself? Or are you going to kiss somebody's butt, you know, and pretend to be what you are not? That's the real point of that book. But I really do feel that women are getting these subtle and not so subtle messages that tell us, hey, don't worry about anybody's feelings anymore. Just go out there like a guy, hit as hard as you can, and grab the goodies and run. I find that a pretty disgusting message.
Journalists are taught to, like, really go after the scoop, to sniff out a story and find out about it and come back with the goods that nobody else can get. How do you think, like, sports journalists should behave when it's somebody's sexual identity that's the story? Stuff which is usually private and which is nowadays making news. But if the people don't really want to talk about it, if they don't want to make that an issue, how do you think journalists should handle it?
Well, there's two or three questions that you've asked. Let me try to separate them out. One, sports writers are neither athletes nor writers. They're the bottom of the journalistic barrel. They're basically jock sniffers. There are a few really good ones, Axelrod, Collins, Brune. There are some fine people out there, the late Red Smith, but most of them are kind of hacks. I mean, not kind of, they are hacks. They haven't got the balls to go get the real story. They wind up becoming unpaid publicity agents. When you open your sports page, you get two stories and only two stories. You get either a simple report of what happened on the court, or you get the personality piece. And the personality piece is either, oh, this person is magic, or this person's a crud. But that's all you get. You never get any real hard information. Now, added to the fact that most sports writers aren't real journalists, is the problem that if they were, they still couldn't get the story, because all sports are closed shops. You can't get into those locker rooms if you aren't I'm going to use some hard language here, if you aren't jerking off the people that run those sports. They're not going to let you in. So even if somebody wanted to break a story, if they did, it would be the end of their career in that sport. So let's say you're a sports writer and you're going after cocaine and football. I mean the real story, not a couple isolated players that are sent to jail, but the fact that the league is run rampant with it. I mean, quarterbacks are taking straws trying to snort up the 50-yard line. That's how bad it is. If you broke that story, you'd never write another football story again. That's why you don't get any real information. In terms of them reporting on the sexuality of the players, they don't. The Billie Jean King affair was made public because of legal proceedings. They knew for years that Marilyn and Billie Jean were lovers. Everybody knew. They didn't write the story. That's one answer. The second answer is this. If homosexuals seek equality, at least equal treatment, doesn't mean you're going to have to like them, but equality under the law, then they are therefore subject to the same kind of scrutiny and sleaze butt press that heterosexuals have had to live with. Think of the case with Lee Marvin and his girlfriend. Think of just all the stuff that Burton and Elizabeth Taylor have gone through. I mean, those people are getting raked over the coals. They're not getting any extra protection or applause because they're heterosexual. So how can the homosexual turn around and cry, oh, poor, pity me? Equal rights also means equal wrongs.
The difference is, though, that Elizabeth Taylor wasn't blacklisted from the film industry because she was openly heterosexual.
No, she wasn't. I don't know if anyone can be blacklisted from the film industry because nobody's had the guts to come out. We won't know until somebody does.
But in tennis, you know, if somebody comes out, as you said, that they lose their endorsements. So it is a really big difference.
They will probably lose their endorsements unless they legally fight it. Nobody can prevent them from going on the court. They can still make a couple $100,000 a year. And, hey, that's not bad. But the real bucks is in the endorsements. Yes, they can potentially lose it. The problem is they're young. They don't have a political insight into their own game. They don't even understand how tennis works. They just want to go on the court. So they don't have any sense of protecting themselves as a group because the players don't make connections with one another. If you and I were players, we're not going to become really good friends because tomorrow we're going to go out in the court and try to kill one another. So every tennis player is isolated from every other tennis player, although they'll have superficial locker room friendships. I'm talking about real friendship. Doesn't exist. Can't exist. Impossible. That doesn't mean they're bad people. It just means they're in a situation that doesn't allow them to get close. They're young. They go on the courts now at 12 and 14. They begin to hit the peak of their careers at 18 and 20. They're dead at 30. They're young. They don't know how to work the system. And by the time they do, it's too late. So they don't know how to protect themselves.
I guess there's a code amongst the players, though, not to talk about other people's lesbianism or homosexuality if it exists.
Yes. They just shut up. They're quite protective of one another, for which I give them a certain amount of real credit.
Rita Mae Brown is my guest, if you're just joining us, and her latest novel is called Sudden Death, and that's just been published by Bantam Books. Do you know when Martina Navratilova was, when that story broke, did her fans get affected by that?
No. People want to see good tennis. They don't care who you sleep with. It isn't the fans that are the problem. It's the people who manufacture tennis rackets and tennis shoes and tennis dresses and tennis underarm deodorants. And it's the promoters. The fans could care. I mean, is there anybody listening out there who does not know there are lesbians in pro women's sports? They all know. The real issue is not lesbians in women's sports. The real issue is homosexuality in men's sports because nobody's got the guts to go after that story. So they rather pick on the women instead.
What do you think the promoters are afraid of and the sponsors?
Well, I guess they think the mother of a 12-year-old tennis whiz won't buy a pair of shoes endorsed by a dyke, afraid it'll rub off on the little darling's feet.
And the sponsors who advertise their products during the game?
That's the same
thing.
It's really quite embarrassing to those of us that are slightly beyond that, and I think most people are. It's just truly embarrassing when it is May 9th in Philadelphia. It's 1940 on the women's pro tennis circuit.
You had mentioned that the real story is which of the male athletes are gay and that nobody's going after that. Do you think that's because people aren't prepared yet to think that real he-man athletes can be gay?
Right. It goes against the stereotype. The stereotype of the female athlete is that it's some big bruiser. The stereotype of the male athlete is of relentless, extravagant heterosexuality. They just can't face it. And, I mean, there's always a portion of the population that's going to be gay. It's like being left-handed. It exists. It will never stop. You cannot make anyone a homosexual. You can't make anyone a heterosexual either. You just are what you are, whether you're in New Zealand or Russia or the U.S. So there's always going to be a portion in football, baseball, basketball that are gay, just like there are left-handed, and that's the end of it. But why? I mean, why the resistance to gay male athletes is so high is really rooted more in men's responses to those male athletes than in women. I don't think women care. I think it's very threatening to quite a few men to think that this gorgeous, big, muscled slugger who can knock out the home runs could be gay. It just violates their sense of gay men, which is, of course, that gay men are quasi-women. The truth is gay men are anything but. They're real men.
Have there been any witch hunts?
Not that I know in male sports. There certainly have been in the female sports. And I have been witness to one of them where some people got fired from the administration of the sport for looking gay. And they in fact were gay, but they were just fired. They were given another reason, obviously. But they canned them. They canned them good. That was a few years back. Not very long ago. That was about a year and a half ago.
Or have there been, are people a lot nosier, like, about the players before they're really brought onto the circuit?
No. There isn't anything you can do about the players except ask them to shut up. Because if the talent is there, you have to accept it. It's not like acting. You know, for acting, you've got 300 people who want the role and maybe 20 who could do it well. So there's choice. I mean, actors and actresses, in fact, have much more reasons to be frightened than, let's say, a sports person. And a sports person, the talent, if the talent is there, it can't be replaced. There's nobody like Chris Everett Lloyd, absolutely nobody. And in that sense, the athletes are in a much better position than people in other branches of the media, because at this point, sport isn't sport. It is media and business. I mean, it's almost foolish to talk about it as a game anymore.
You talk about how people always assume that there must be a lot of love relationships between the male and the female tennis stars, and that doesn't happen at all. How come?
There are a couple reasons. One is there's only three tournaments where the men and women are together, the U.S. Open, Wimbledon. I think they're together at the French Open. I don't know if they're together at the Italian, but by and large, they're two completely separate circuits. I mean, the Italian Open, they're not even together anymore. So there's fewer opportunities for them to get together. And I think the men want starlets. They want pretty little girls to follow them around, etc. Extremely feminine creatures in the culturally defined sense of feminine. So they look down their nose at the female players.
When you were with Martina Navratilova, everybody knows you're gay.
Yes, they do.
I mean, you write books about it. Articles have been written about you. Was she nervous about you being around, since that would...
I can't speak
probably
for her.
Mean something?
I mean, you would have to ask her that issue. In terms of myself, if she was, she never said so. So I had no sense of that at all.
I guess it's you're really one of the few people who is in the position of being out as openly as you are. I mean, a lot of people are openly out, but it's like part of what you do, really, since your books tend to frequently be about homosexuality. I guess you're really lucky, because for a lot of people that's a hurdle to overcome, and for you it's not something you have to overcome in your career, though maybe in film that's still to be tested.
No. In film all they care is, can you make the money? And indeed I can. I think what it's done, it has impeded my career by about 10 years, and I know that. If I had written a book as funny and original as Ruby Fruit in my late 20s, but it were heterosexual, I would have been hailed as the coming princess of literature to be crowned queen in my 50s, assuming my talent could develop and grow. That's not the case, of course. I still go out and have to be dubbed a lesbian writer when, in fact, half of my books are about heterosexuals. If they wanted to be accurate, I suppose they should call me an AC/DC writer. They call Alice Walker a black writer. They do not call Norman Mailer a Jewish heterosexual writer. So the label's pejorative, and I know the label's pejorative, and any label is pejorative, as far as I'm concerned, unless you want to start labeling Updike and everybody. How is it that some of us are just writers, but others are black writers and Chinese writers and gay writers? So I know that's wrong, and I have to fight that through. But in terms of my own life, I don't intend to live my life as a liar, and there's nothing anybody can do to induce me to lie.
Yeah, you said that your book, Sudden Death, is really about whether you're going to have the courage to say who you are and live your life, or whether you're going to kind of kiss people's butt, as you put it, and pretend to be things that you're not. Do you think it shows a lack of courage for people who are in professional sports to not come out, knowing how the career would be jeopardized by it? Or do you think people should take it on?
Yes and
on themselves
no.
To do it?
It's a yes and no answer. Sure, it shows a lack of courage if you're put in the spot and you back down. You know, there are 1,000 reasons for failure, but no excuses. However, these people could make it so much easier upon themselves if they would make common cause with one another and, in a sense, come out as a group and say, yes, some of us are gay and some of us are straight, and that's the end of it. You know, we're not going to buy into this anymore, and we're not going to hide. We are what we are. You'd better get over it. As long as it's put on the individual, it makes it much harder for them to come forward. And unfortunately, in sports, as in most aspects of our lives, the competition for these slots is quite fierce. So the impulse is not to help one another, but to kind of try to push the other guy down and get as much as you can for yourself, the great American way. You know, America lives under the 11th commandment, each against all. And it does us great damage as a culture as well as individuals.
What kind of response have you gotten to your book from tennis players?
Well, quite an interesting one. So far, about 5 people have contacted me, 3 players and 2 people that are administrators and 1 person that's a sports announcer. And they've laughed. I mean, the responses from them have been very positive. Other people could be just furious. I mean, I may go home to find a bomb in my mailbox. I don't know. I think the impulse in any profession is to present a public image, and that's always much sweeter and nicer than people really are. And what I did is I went behind the scenes, the stories behind the scenes, not on the court. And Sudden Death is about the hustlers and the promoters and the dirty deals, as well as the good people. And obviously that's going to be very disquieting to people who simply want to go along, in a sense, with their paid publicity image.
Is anybody annoyed in the sense that they feel that they refer to in the book in a pejorative way?
The funny thing is, people live in terror that they will be in my books and then are furious when they find out they're not included.
The book we're talking about is Sudden Death, and the author is my guest, Rita Mae Brown, and the book's just been published in hardcover by Bantam. You've been writing movies now, and the movie that I know of that you wrote was Slumber Party, which I didn't get to see. Didn't play here very long, I think, but the ad made it look like a real slasher type film. It was like 2 girls in a nightgown or something with someone wielding an axe above them, implying that one of them was about to get hacked up. What was the movie like?
I didn't see it myself. The screenplay that I wrote was a spoof of horror movies, just a send-up of the whole genre. And it sat on the shelf for 3 years. And when Roger Corman pulled it down, I gather he decided to make it a straight horror movie and left all the spoof out, which, of course, was very upsetting for me, because I had hoped to kind of explode the genre and, in fact, wound up right in the middle of it. And Women Against Violence to Get Women were very upset with me, thinking, of course, that I had magical powers. I didn't, and not understanding the film business, which is when you sell a product, it's like a car. They drive it away and they drive it wherever they want. As a result of that film, though, I mean, I would be pretending that I didn't benefit by it. I didn't get any money for it. I only got paid union wage. But I certainly benefited by the fact that I made Roger a lot of money. And that's all they care about in Hollywood. And as a result of that, I got a job doing a screenplay for Walt Disney, which I just finished the second draft. And I've been doing a lot of work out there. I got nominated for an Emmy last year for a show I did with Norman Lear. And with some other writers, that turned out quite well for me. I'm very fortunate to be able to write in many different forms. Some people can do one form only, and I'm a little bit more ecumenical.
I think if I were you and I had a movie that I meant to be a spoof and it came out not as a spoof, I'd still go see it anyways because I'd be dying of curiosity. How did you resist?
I don't care. I hate horror movies. I mean, if it were the spoof, I'd go, but I wouldn't pay anybody money to see a straight horror movie. I despise them.
They used your name, I think, in the ads.
How could they not? I was the writer. You know, all they did was take stuff out. They may have added some stuff, I'm not sure. But that's the nature of that business, and people that aren't in the film business don't understand that nothing can happen without a writer, but nobody pays any attention to the writer. They take your work and you lose all power over it. That's a director's medium and a producer's medium, and that's it.
What were the spoof parts like?
Oh, they were funny. You know, bumbling attempts to kill. Just in situations that you've seen a thousand times, you know, where somebody is stalking through the bushes and their footlands and dog manure, that kind of stuff. Just fun, making fun of it.
So it's not the kind of thing you'd sue over or anything?
No, nor should I. If I'm going to be in this business, I better get a tough hide.
So you're working on a Disney film now?
Yeah, I finished it. I'll probably have to do a polish or two. But that was they're a remarkable outfit to work with because they're first class all the way. I've never worked with anything like that in my life. I mean, everything they do beautifully.
What's the script about?
It's about a girl, young woman, who gets a job in a big department store in Houston, and she learns about life on the job. It's interesting. 15 years ago, a coming-of-age movie would have meant you slept with somebody for the first time. Now, coming of age means you learn about the world on the workplace. And that's a little bit of progress, and I was very happy to participate in that.
When do you think the film will be coming out?
Well, we'll shoot it in Houston in the late fall, probably be out, I'd say, 6 months after that.
How is your book, Sudden Death, being advertised? Do the publishers feel comfortable billing it as a book about lesbianism in tennis, or...
I don't know because I haven't seen any of the ads. I mean, I'm just moving through these cities at a lightning pace. Don't know really what they've done, but I have a certain amount of faith in Bantam. I would hope they wouldn't do anything offensive to me or to the book because the book is lesbianism is the vehicle. The book is really about your integrity. What are you worth to you?
Do you feel that a lot of people in tennis have jeopardized their integrity by the way they've behaved?
Not tennis. I feel that a lot of people in America have sold their soul in the installment plan to the highest bidder.
Is that a trap that you have to be careful of in movies now since there's so many options to lose your... so many ways you can lose your integrity in films?
Well, you can't lose your integrity in the sense that if I sign on to a project and do the best job I can on the page, whatever happens when it leaves me, there isn't very much I can do about it. All I can try to do is be true to myself on the page. You certainly can be angry. You certainly can be sick when you see what's been done to your work. But conversely, you can be aided. I have seen weak lines made sing by the right actress or the right actor. So it cuts both ways, and I'm just not going to sit and weep and wail about it and say, oh, poor me. I think I have been helped sometimes as much as hurt, and nobody can make me write what I don't want to. So in that sense, I'm quite fortunate. I've paid my dues. I mean, I came from poverty, and I didn't make any real money until my 30s, so I was willing to starve and possibly spend the rest of my life starving to do what I wanted to do. It's a little harder when you work in a corporation, but I don't think it's as hard as people make it. You know, nobody has put a gun to your head and said, you must do this. This is America. We have some choices. I'd like for us to have more, but we still have some choices. And what I find that upsets me very much is most people wildly trying to abdicate responsibility for their own life. It's mother's fault, or it's their employer's fault, or it's their lover's fault, but it's never their fault.
One of the choices you can make now is how do you want to build a life with the money that you're making, because that gives you a lot of choices that you wouldn't have without it. What kind of life are you trying to build with that as far as...
Well, I have people to support. I mean, one of the things about coming from poverty is that you have to carry people out with you. A middle-class kid hits it big and all the money is available to her or him. This is not true with me. I have to share whether I want to or not. And to be blunt, sometimes I resent it and then I hate myself because I think I'm petty, but sometimes I wish I could just have it all for me, you know, so that I could be foolish. What I've tried to do is I have a farm, and I've got it set up as a farm so that it runs, and I can grow my own food, which I know it sounds corny, but it's real important to me to grow my own food. And that I like, and I've been able to build myself a quiet zone. It's very difficult for me to work in cities. I get quite distracted by the noises. And so for me, the money has been to find a place of peace and quiet. And then on the good years, and I've had some good ones, I've also had some bad ones, I try to take 10% after taxes and give it to a group that I believe in so that it can operate politically in the community in some constructive fashion. If the Catholic Church can be run by the tithing of its members. I believe those of us who care about social causes must do the same thing. You have to give 10%. If you can't give 10, give 5, but give something.
I think a lot of people, when they make it, feel like, great, now they'll really be part of a scene. They'll be someone who people like to hang out with and be seen with, and they'll have, you know, access to great parties and expensive restaurants. And you've chosen to live on a farm in South Carolina,
Charlottesville, Virginia.
Virginia, yeah. So you've chosen to, like, leave the scene.
I never was in it. I don't want any part of it. I'm not a particularly social creature. I don't have any trouble with that. People who want to be jet-setty and beautiful, go ahead. I mean, hey, look, it doesn't hurt me if somebody wants to do that, but I don't want to do it. I haven't got a lot of time for chit-chat and what's the latest in thing, because the latest in thing will be out 6 months from now. I can't be bothered with it.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us today. Thanks for being
here. Oh, it's nice to be back. You and I have done this over the years. I feel like I'm talking to a friend.
Good luck with your new book, and thanks for being here.
Thank you.